This is Fresh Air. Our guest, David Mitchell, writes novels that often combine literary fiction with genres like science fiction and fantasy. In his new novel, Slade House, the characters who walk down the narrow alley called Slade Alley risk being ensnared by two soul-sucking vampires. Slade House is a companion to Mitchell's 2014 book, The Bone Clocks, but it started out as a story Mitchell wrote on Twitter. David Mitchell has been shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize twice. His novels include The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet and Cloud Atlas, which was adapted into a film. Mitchell's 2006 semi-autobiographical novel, Black Swan Green, was about a 13-year-old navigating through adolescence with an embarrassing stammer. Mitchell said that dealing with his own stammer helped him become a writer. In 2013, Mitchell and his wife, Keiko Yoshida, translated the book The Reason I Jump, a memoir by a 13-year-old Japanese boy describing his experience of autism. Mitchell has said that the book helped him with his own autistic son. David Mitchell spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger.
David Mitchell, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Sam. It's great to be here.
So the first chapter of this book, Slade House, started out as a story you wrote on Twitter. Why did you want to write a story on Twitter, and why did you decide then to expand the original story into a longer book?
I wanted to write the story on Twitter because I was a little bit embarrassed at having this Twitter account that my publisher really was only ever using to publicise bookshop appearances and the like. However, I don't really want to tweet about my private life. I don't feel it's that interesting, and my privacy is important. So I didn't really have a means to use it that felt legitimate until I hit upon the idea of using it as a sort of a vehicle for fiction, which is what I'm interested about. So I already had the story. I translated it into tweets and then put those out over the course of about 2 or 3 weeks last year.
Did you like the restrictions that Twitter placed upon you?
I like what I had to do to circumvent those restrictions. I view many artistic endeavours as being perhaps analogous to straitjackets. And the more demonic and tortuous the straitjacket is, the more audacious the act of escapology has to be to get out of that straitjacket. And if all goes well, that audacity, that escapology, turns into an original manuscript, something not quite like something you've read before. And it isn't that I like the restrictions, I like what you have to do to get around the restrictions.
The victims of Slade House, right before their souls are going to be devoured, they actually see their souls, like their souls are these float in front of their faces, and they're these globes, they look to some like tiny galaxies, and each one of them finds that soul beautiful. And not all of these people you have sympathy for. One of them is a corrupt and racist police officer. But since all of them see the soul as beautiful, that suggested to me some sort of redemption. Was that your intent?
Every character that I'm asking the reader to root for has to have the potential for redemption, simply because you can't care about a monster. Indeed, you would want the monster to come to a sticky ending as soon as possible. So I hope, not just for the characters in Slade House, but for all the characters I write, even the less sympathetic ones, they do need that flicker, that gleam of the possibility that they could or could have become more enlightened human beings. Perhaps people who commit genocide, maybe they have gone beyond some kind of a line whereby they are no longer redeemable. But certainly in the much more humdrum confines of my own life, even dislikable people, you can see more worthy, valid aspects in them, and perhaps you can also sort of see why life or a series of bad decisions or wrong calls or just rotten luck or maybe an abusive background has made them the way they are. And That's what makes them interesting. That's what makes human beings interesting. Nothing is as dull as a character who is sort of merely, who's just merely bad and always is bad. And what's the point? And they're not that realistic anyway. And so, yeah.
You've said that your 2006 novel, Black Swan Green, is semi-autobiographical. It's set in a small town in 1980s England and narrated by this aspiring poet, 13-year-old Jason Taylor, who is navigating adolescence, the deterioration of his parents' marriage, Lord of the Flies-like social structure among his peers, and a pretty debilitating stammer he tries to hide and that makes most of his conversations, you know, like a dance through a minefield. You have a stammer.
I do indeed, yeah.
In the book, Jason describes the first time when his stammer erupted. Did you have a moment like that?
Yeah, that was pretty autobiographical, that section. And we were playing hangman. And I can't remember the example I used in the book. Your knowledge of the book seems to exceed my own, but I'm pretty sure it was the word Napoleon. And I knew it.
It was Nightingale.
Is it Nightingale in
yes,
the book?
Yes, in the book.
Right, right. Wow, how'd you know that? That's scary.
Sorry, but I had the book in front of me. I will not lie.
And yes, I couldn't say it. And that was the first time I blocked. I was a late developer with speaking. I didn't really speak till I was five, and I'm sure that was a factor. But then I was kind of okay for a bit, but it was a lull before a storm.
So, as you say, that this occurs during a game of hangman, and so Jason personifies his stammer by calling it the hangman. And I was wondering if you also thought of your stammer as an adversary.
Oh yes, you do. It's this curse. It's this invisible doppelganger that's just out to wreck your life and destroy you and humiliate you and mortify you whenever it can, is how you think about it, and you view it as something you need to fight. There's not that much knowledge about speech impediments amongst people who don't stammer, and they parrot the lazy and, if you think about it, intellectually absurd idea that it's because you're not trying hard enough. But as a kid you believe that and you think, oh well, everyone's saying it must be true, therefore I have to try harder. But of course, the more you try to exterminate your stammer, the more it fights back, and you just sort of it's not a way to live. You can't be in a state of civil war with yourself. And it wasn't for years that I realized this and came around to the idea that, hey, it's okay to stammer. It's perfectly all right. And if anyone has a problem with it, it's their problem and not yours. And oddly enough, it's that conviction, it's that belief, it's this militant, well, you got a problem with my stammer? Screw you. It's actually that militancy, not aimed in at yourself, but sort of out at your mockers. It's that helps. That really helps. It's as if you're giving your stammer the right to exist.
Well, you've said in past interviews that you think your stammer was a part of the reason you became a writer, that in conversation you'd have to find ways to avoid certain triggering words that could cause you to stammer, so you're always thinking about different ways to say things. But it must have been so stressful to have to be cautious about everything you were saying.
Yes, it is. Yeah, welcome to our world.
But especially as a 13-year-old, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you've got enough wrong with you when you're 13 anyway, so you think. But this one, you can't even speak about it. It's really stressful. Every line you sort of scan like an auto cue to look for words you will block on. It's always a small number of syllables, in my case consonants, usually consonants, and I could see them coming up. Hard C's and K's, I have a hard time with them. I still have a hard time with S's. And I was only 13 and I didn't have the strategies that I later evolved. But as you alluded to just now, Sam, one of the things you can and do is to work out different ways to sort of short circuit or rather bypass the blocking words. So I think for a while I had a problem with hard Ds as well. So if I was phoning a friend, couldn't say, what are you doing today? Because I'd block on the doing, which I still do slightly, in fact. I would I would say, what are you up to today, for example. It's great being my age. I love being able to talk about it like this, you know. Until I wrote Black Swan Green, this would be a subject that would cause me to sweat and turn red, even if the subject went anywhere near stammering. It's so much nicer to be able to analyse it and think of it as a legitimate part of me.
Jason writes poems under the pseudonym of Elliot Bolivar, and those are published in the Parish Magazine. I think you did that too, but your pseudonym was James Bolivar. Is that right?
That's right. Oh, it's so embarrassing to admit this on the radio.
Do you remember any of those early poems?
I haven't forgotten them well enough. They're mostly nature poems. And God, I made some utterly pretentious drivel after the nature poems. Like, the nature poems were the best ones. And then after, I went through a phase where I thought I was really good. And that, of course, is when the poetry was sort of unreadably, it was just utter tosh of the first and stinkiest order. I think my mum might have some in a box in an attic somewhere. But
can you recite any for us?
No way. You could not. You would not be able to get me drunk enough, my friend, before I could sign.
We're all friends.
No one I. Yeah, I'm sure we are, but there is no one I love enough that you could kidnap to coerce me to begin to recite.
We'll have to go.
I can't really remember. I mean, I just remember a few titles, but even them, no.
In 2013, you published a book that you and your wife Keiko Yoshida translated from Japanese. It's called The Reason I Jump. Its author, Naoki Higashida, was a 13-year-old boy at the time it was written. He's autistic and nonverbal, so the original book was written with Higashida pointing to Japanese characters on a grid, and then someone would transcribe those thoughts. And the majority of the book is in a question and answer form, with him describing what it's like to live with autism. He answers questions like, why can't you have a proper conversation? Why don't you make eye contact when you're talking? Your son has autism, and you've said that this book was incredibly helpful for you in understanding what your son's experience is like. What was so helpful about it?
Because there was a lot of overlap between Naoki's presentations of autism and our son's. So that's the first thing. We think of autism as one set of fairly well-defined symptoms. It's not. It's vast, and there are as many different kinds of autism as there are people with autism, really. And just because sort of one book might be really helpful about one type, one manifestation, that doesn't mean it would be helpful for any others. But as it happens, there was quite a useful overlap between Naoki's autism and our son's. That's reason one. Reason two, many books are written by experts, or they're written by carers, or they're written by people with autism, but very high-functioning autism, more towards the Asperger's end of the pool than towards the kind of autism that our son has, which is fairly hardcore, fairly nonverbal. So again, there was that overlap there. And it was from the inside. It was from the planet of autism. It very often felt as if Naoki was giving our son a voice. And if our son could say what was happening in his head, then he would say something like this. This made me understand that that so much more is going on in our son's head than is apparent, and that many of the problems and the challenges that our son faces, I mean, he gets enough from the autism itself, but we were compounding that. We were piling them on through our own ignorance about autism. And this is true for every autistic person on earth. we cause a hell of a lot of the problems, us neurotypicals, because we don't get it. We jump to false assumptions. We even congratulate ourselves on our knowledge that, for example, people with autism, kids with autism, they prefer to be on their own in the corner, lining up their toys in a line or something, and they're happiest there. And if they're not, they want the human interaction. It's just we're so lousy at understanding how to do it that we get it wrong, thereby driving them into the corner. See, you see what I mean? We sort of confuse our wrong actions with their preferred behaviours. and they can't point it out because they have autism. What a fate, really, what a fate. But when you know that mischievousness is there, when you know that intellect and intelligence and that desire for interactivity is there, then you change the way you behave. We did with our son, and it yielded good results. You know, it's not a cure. The book won't sort of fix your kid's autism, but it will fix many of the problems with your interaction.
Well, David Mitchell, thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's been a great pleasure speaking with you, Sam. Thanks for having me on your program.
David Mitchell spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Mitchell's new novel is called Slate House. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, I'll talk with Peter Sohn, the director of the new Disney-Pixar animated film, The Good Dinosaur. Before we go, I want to wish a happy anniversary to This American Life. Its first episode, broadcast 20 years ago today, started like this.
Franklin?
I'm ready.
It's Ira Glass here.
Oh, you're the MC on the show, Ira.
I am the MC on the show, yes.
Oh, great. Ira?
Ira,
I-R-A. Oh, great. Now, hold on one second, Ira. Don't go away.
Thank you, Ira, for the great stories, the groundbreaking investigations, and for being an all-around radio genius who is a constant inspiration. And thank you for continuing to lead the way and constantly surprising us. Happy anniversary from all your fans at Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.